Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Hop-Ons podcast, an Arrested Development review podcast brought to you by Nice Marmot Productions. Did I get that right?
You did. Absolutely.
Terrific. I am one of your hosts, Colin Cox.
And I am your other host, John Phelps.
John, Arrested Development is arguably the funniest TV show in the history of television.
Agreed. Absolutely.
That is our premise for this show. And we, from one episode to the next, will watch and discuss each episode of Arrested Development, including the fourth season, which was released on Netflix in 2013.
Yes. And I think they're making a new one. That's what I've heard.
I've heard new season, maybe a movie.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
But today we're talking about the pilot episode.
And yes.
Here's a little bit of information about the pilot. This is perhaps how we'll start each episode. Written, of course, by Mitch Hurwitz and directed by the Russo brothers, who you may know.
Oh, wow.
I know you know these guys because they directed that new Captain America movie, right?
Yes, they did. And the second Captain America movie. Yeah.
Okay. They directed this episode.
That is I didn't know that. Bananas. That's funny that I said that. That's crazy.
They directed a lot of the episodes from the first season.
Wow.
I know. It originally aired on November 2nd, 2003 on Fox. It was viewed by 7.98 million, which if you're listening, you might think, wait, that sounds great, doesn't it? Let's put this into a bit of context. Earlier that night, The Simpsons, their Halloween episode aired. It was viewed by 16.2 million people. A few days earlier, on Thursday, Friends, by the way, was still a TV show at the time.
Yes.
19 million viewers. Mm. And in the 10 p.m., I believe it was 10 p.m. time slot, Law & Order Criminal Intent, 13.5 million. So not a lot of viewers, I'm afraid.
Right, but I have to bring up the Law & Order. There are so many old people that watch Law & Order. That's like their demographics, basically, our grandpas. That's what they go for.
I think you're right. And something we'll talk about, how this show is so amazing, but no one really watched it.
Yeah.
And part of the problem was because Fox would just shuffle it around from one night to the next.
Yeah, they kept putting it in what was known as like the death slot over and over and over and over. And it gained this like cult following, but it was just never enough.
I know. And that's really disappointing.
Yeah.
So the show, a couple of awards, by the way. Mitch Hurwitz won a writing award, and the Russo brothers won a directing award for this episode.
For Emmys, right? They won Emmys.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yes. So they won Emmys for both of these. Excuse me. Both of them won Emmys for this episode.
For the pilot. That's crazy.
For the pilot. Yeah.
Wow.
People like the pilot so much. It was compared initially to the Royal Tenenbaums, Wes Anderson film.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
But most people agreed it wasn't nearly as sardonic as the Royal Tenenbaums.
Right, yeah.
It's doing discernibly different things with this notion of family and the responsibilities we have toward family.
Yeah.
And before we start, here is an IMDb summary, which is funny because it's woefully oversimplified. But anyway, after his father fails to promote him within the family business, Michael accepts a job in Arizona until his dad is arrested for shady bookkeeping. I told John before we started two things. First, if you watch the episode, you know he accepts the job after George has been arrested. And maybe this is something we don't get from the pilot, but it's clear as the season progresses, his crimes are not as simple as shady bookkeeping.
Yeah, not in the least.
Not in the least. So let's jump right into this episode. John, where would you like to start?
Let's start with one of the first joke in the show after we get some narration by Ron Howard is you see Lucille come in. They're on a boat. They're celebrating. You think they're celebrating that Michael's going to become a new partner, and he's really excited about it. Lucille comes down, and the first thing she says is, "Look what the homosexuals have done to me this time." And it's one of my all-time favorite jokes. And Michael says, "Can't they just comb it out and do it over?" And it's just the most perfect thing in the world, because from that moment on, there's just running gags all over the place. Like, that, like, is what sets everything off.
And it beautifully encapsulates the way Michael interacts with his mother.
Yes.
He doesn't take her seriously at all.
I think that if he did, he would probably go like insane.
I think so, too. I think we are seeing this family, and we're starting to see this family at a particular moment in time when Michael is teetering on the precipice of just throwing his hands in the air and deciding, that's it. I'm done. Yeah, I'm finished with these people.
Yeah.
So that leads me to think there might have been a time when he was really sympathetic toward his mother, and now he's just in this bizarre fourth wall breaking place where it's as if he's talking to us more than he is anyone else.
Yeah, I think he is like, I think he basically is our kind of our voice, like the viewer voice for this whole insane thing that's happening. So from that first moment, you know, then you see a literally a barge full of gay guys come by. And she says the phrase, they make me want to set myself on fire, which is also one of my favorite jokes. But again, that joke is wrapped around again at the end of the series. And they do this perfect kind of Seinfeld-esque dovetail with Tobias being on the barge and all that. And I think the first time I watched this, of course, I didn't know that. But now I've watched it again and again and again. That's the most one of the most brilliant story devices in the show is they have jokes that are like, you know, seasons from now, we're going to get a joke that was in the pilot. And Mitch Hurwitz is really good at writing.
He's really quite clever. And the way the show plays with misdirection. So when Lindsay then approaches and there's a cut to she married this man.
Yeah.
But there's a parenthetical that says not on boat. But what's funny though. As a viewer, you're not sure which boat they're talking about.
Yeah, of course. Because right,
there are two boats.
I didn't even think about that. That's so amazing. Well,
because I thought as I was rewatching it this time, wait, are they trying to imply that Tobias isn't on the boat of gay protesters? Because we learn later in the episode that he clearly is.
He is, yeah.
But he's not on the boat as a protester. He's there because he thought.
Just like
he thought the party was a pirate theme
because Michael just randomly mentions it and Tobias goes with it, and that again that joke will set up the is Tobias gay jokes like throughout the entire course of the show.
So there are two things I want to we'll come back to this. I want to talk about, does Tobias willingly misinterpret people, or is that just a problem he has?
Go ahead, sorry.
But the second thing, this show, well over 10 years old at this point.
Yeah.
And I would argue almost all of the jokes age so, so well.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I thought we could talk, do you think the gay jokes still work? Because I think you could argue a lot of the jokes, especially a lot of the jokes about Tobias, not only across the show, but even in this episode, the jokes are predicated on this notion that, well, Tobias is gay, but he doesn't know it and isn't that funny. And I wonder if those jokes still work as well.
I don't know if I want to say Tobias is, I don't know if I think that's the joke as much as it is Tobias is totally clueless about everything and he just keeps getting himself in these situations. Now, I think maybe they go over the line later with like the leather daddy joke, stuff like that. But I think this joke is a perfect example of Tobias just being almost totally innocent. There are really only a few moments where Tobias is like he's angry or he gets upset about something. But for the most part, he's just like this very lovely man that just wanders into these horrible situations. Like when he loses his medical license at the beginning because he gives somebody CPR because he thinks they're dying, but they're not. He breaks someone's sternum and he loses his medical license.
Can we talk about the way that's edited? Because the way they edit the boat footage, the final thing he's doing, it looks like he's just shoving his elbow into God's sternum. And I don't know, because when Tobias gives his credentials later in the episode, the man has legitimate credentials.
Yes, he does.
He hasn't received a medical license from some online for-profit university. He has legitimate medical skills, but why is he so bad at so many things?
And I think when he gives his credentials, also one of the best scenes because he has decided he wants to become an actor. And like you have this great, and this is a use of the Russo brothers, like great direction. We have this like medium wide shot on him and he's like, hello, I'm Tobias Funke. I'm a doctor. And he gives like all these credentials. And then we just like slowly pan out and he's like on a high school stage.
And I love that building, by the way, because I teach in a high school. that looks like a public high school.
It does, absolutely.
The walls, just watch the episode again. Look at those walls. Those walls are disgusting. And that's exactly what a high school looks like. But I think you're right. And I think the show, it would be different if we were meant to sympathize with Lucille or Lindsay or anyone else who makes a gay joke, but the show is deliberately putting us against them. They in many ways antagonize our sensibility. So I think you're right. I don't think the show's endorsing those kinds of jokes. It's presenting them to us, and they may or may not cross a particular line, but Michael's never making those jokes.
Right.
George Michael's never making those jokes.
Right.
I don't even think Maybe's really ever making those jokes.
No, I don't think so.
It's Lucille, and she's horrible.
It's definitely Lucille. She's a terrible person, but she's so wonderful.
She is. She is. So
let me ask you, what did you think of the episode overall?
I thought it was nearly flawless.
I did too. Yeah.
I like it so much because there are so many shows today, whether it's Parks and Recreation or The Office, shows that are clearly grandchildren to this show and this show's sensibilities and the Arrested Development DNA that's so apparent in so many of our comedic sensibilities today. So much so that, my God, if you watched the first presidential debate, Hillary Clinton did two camera takes like Jim from The Office. I mean, her mood and her demeanor in many ways was aping what Michael does in this show. So it seems as though this sensibility has permeated the cultural consciousness in ways that is impossible to quantify. And I think that for me is what makes the show so amazing, just watching the influence. But in addition to that, if this show did nothing to influence cultural sensibilities, it's just hilarious. And what this show did for the entire cast, the actor who plays Job.
Will Arnett. Yeah, yeah.
Will Arnett did not have a career really before this show. David Cross was perhaps more of a known entity, but David Cross has become so incredibly popular because of this show.
Yeah.
Tony Hale was in a VW commercial before this show.
Yeah, and then now he's like on Veep, and he's
exactly
off.
Just what this show has done. Michael Cera, the Michael Cera aesthetic and ethos, was created by this show.
Yes.
This show has done so much, whether we realize it or not, to influence what we think is funny. But again, just independent of all of that, it's a flawless bit of comedic television.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Job, can we talk about Job as a magician?
Please, let's talk about Job.
How long do you think Job has been a magician?
I would say Job has probably been practicing the art of magic for about a solid month when this happened. That would be my guess. He is, you could tell that he's one of those guys that he went to a magic shop one day and there was like a group of them talking and he was like, man, I really want to be a part of this and I have a lot of money. So his mom was like, please just get out of my face. Here's some money. Buy whatever you want to buy. And so he like that. And I think it perfectly because in this show we get the Aztec tomb, which is his big magic trick or whatever. And he spends $18,000 and they make a point to say this was 18 grand, Michael.
And it's a career maker, implies that his career hasn't been made. So I think that compliments what you just said, that he's clearly someone who on a random Tuesday just decided, I think I can do magic. Right.
I know I could probably do this. Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think I told you he created the Magician's Alliance. But when the show cuts to that picture,
yes,
the sign doesn't say behind them Magician's Alliance, it says the Alliance of Magicians.
Yeah,
so
I never
it
noticed
seems
that.
As though even Job completely forgot the organization he created or the name of the organization he created. But he also, another funny thing, we never see Job use a magic wand really, but it's in the segue when he's trying to convince Micah. Yeah, so it's you can see it. It's positioned on the left in the basket. It's the only time we see Job with a wand, really.
Like the mise-en-scene's perfect for that.
Yeah,
let's
it is.
Job a wand.
Yeah, it's when he's trying to convince Michael to let him do the Aztec tomb at the party, and there's just a little magic wand sitting there.
And that brings me to the point where I think that the segue humor in this is so funny. Like, Job always being on a segue and using it to get out of situations, it's just, it's so goddamn funny. It's so funny.
Well, the way, he uses the segue for comedic humor. I mean, the same way the droids are used comedically in Star Wars, just the way they're falling and bumbling about, and the way other other real actors are asked to interact with them, the way he interacts with the Segway. And there's a, this is later, I believe, in season two, when he's trying to make a point, he pushes the Segway towards someone. And it's, but we get a lot of that. We get a lot of that in this episode. The turn when he turns away from Michael after he's revealed that Lindsay is actually in town. Yeah. It's God, it's so funny. You're
it's
right.
And so great.
I wonder how much, I want to know how much time Will Arnett spent on a Segway.
Yeah, it almost became a part of him. He had to get to know that thing like very, very deeply. They had to have a connection.
I know.
It's just, it's because it is like a part of Job's character.
Indeed. But I think this is my point. I would guess, because this is just a pilot for a network TV show, actors, when you listen to them, especially TV actors, talk about how many pilots they've made in relation to how many have actually been produced. It's staggering just how many pilots actors make.
It's unbelievable, yeah.
But he is so convincing on this segue. But I can't imagine he would have spent that much time practicing with it.
I wonder if he just like is a natural talent he has.
I think he,
if they just gave Will Arnett a segue and he's like, I'm going to incorporate this into my character.
I know. We'll talk about this obviously when we get to season two, but when he tries to go over a rock.
Oh my God, it's awesome.
On the segue, it's
it's just perfect. I think that Job, for the most part of the show, Job was always my favorite character. And in this episode, I feel like he lets out that he's like super arrogant when he has nothing to back it up, which is one of my favorite qualities of Job. But he also is really mean and rarely caring, but he's so mean in like this weird endearing way that you just love him.
I know. And I don't think I realized, because this show is doing interesting things with alcohol and how alcohol relates to villainous characters.
Yeah.
At least in the pilot, Job drinks all the time.
I noticed that. Yeah.
He always has a whiskey or a scotch in his hand. And the same thing happens with Lucille, right? Mm-hmm. She always has a drink in her hand, and she's mean, and she's this unlikable character, and she says unlikable things to people because of her alcohol abuse. So this is one of the times where I think, is this show being very conservative because it conflates alcoholism with villainy?
I don't know. I think, like, I have this idea in my head of like an archetype of what Job and Lucille are.
Right.
And they're like this, you know, the upper echelon of society, this upper class, especially Lucille. You know, she's like a stern businesswoman, and her drinking martinis all the time does not in any way make me like equate that with she's mean. I just imagine that's what she would do, is wake up in the morning, you know, pop some Xanax and start chugging martinis. Like, that's what Lucille would do. And Job is always having a bourbon or something. Of course he would. He's a failed magician that his dad, like, hides his dad in a magic trick. I mean, come on. That's perfect.
I know.
It's just amazing.
I know. It's such a wonderful show for that reason, because it plays with those archetypes.
Yeah.
But it doesn't keep those characters in those simplified archetypal positions.
Right,
it builds on them, because later we learn Lucille is not an aristocrat. She's not a member of the nouveau riche. She connived her way into that position, but she does such a beautiful job of appearing that way. And this is really a show about appearances, because George, and we can talk about George is the CEO of this company. And George Sr.
Yeah,
and George Sr. Because there's so many Georges. This is
way too many.
Everyone has a George name somewhere. But he's the CEO of this company. We're led to believe it's a successful company, obviously, until about, two-thirds of the way into the episode, when, in fact, it's revealed that he's been manipulating and lying to his investors, and as we're told in the show, using his company as a piggy bank.
A piggy bank, yeah.
To support himself and his family and all of their indiscretions. But he appears one way, but it's revealed at the end of the show that he's something fundamentally different. But he's also someone who goes through phases, and those phases are embodied by a change in his appearance.
Yes,
in this episode, we're led to believe that he is in the middle of a cowboy phase.
Yeah, it reminds me, like, he's this Texas oil man, basically. That's what he wants to be.
Okay.
Yeah, but he's definitely not. And I think that what's so perfect is when you actually see him in his environment before he goes to his gangster phase, which happens at the end of this, his gangster rap phase. You see that as a businessman, I had it like a CEO of a business. The man's an idiot. Like, he's just completely stupid.
He is. Is this because this is a show, and we'll talk about this more in season two. This is a show that's quite critical of the Bush administration.
Yes, absolutely.
I always assumed this was a not so subtle criticism of George Bush.
I could definitely see that, yeah.
Because he looks like, and he even tries to talk. I don't know if this is in the pilot episode or the extended pilot, and you and I talked about this a little bit.
Yeah.
When we hear some of his speech and he says things like, it's time for me to mosey on.
Yeah.
And he's appropriating some of that language, but in appearance as an idiotic leader of what appears to be a successful company, this feels not unlike George Bush.
I agree.
During the early aughts, right? This idiot who's leading presumably the greatest country in the world, but there's nothing there. He's just an idiot.
Yeah, I wouldn't call George Senior a simpleton. I would call him the guy who, like, he tries so hard to look like he knows what the hell he's doing, but he has literally no idea. And one of my favorite jokes in the show is in this episode, when at the end he's in jail, he's been arrested, you know, for insider trading and using the company as a piggy bank. And he's talking to Michael, and Michael goes, why didn't you make me partner? Because he makes Lucille partner. And he goes, why didn't you make me partner? And George Sr. leans in like, let me tell you something secretly. And he goes, they can't charge a husband and wife for the same crime. And he throws a wink at him. I love it so much. And Michael goes, yeah, that's not true.
But even Michael, so the exact line is, yeah, I don't think that's true,
yeah,
Dad.
Yeah, I don't think that's true.
Okay, so the I think, because that's clearly not true. That's not, I don't think you need to know anything about the law to know that that's the stupidest thing anyone could possibly say. I wonder if that implies that Michael really loves his father.
I think so,
because he's so gentle with him at that moment. Yeah, I don't think that's true, Dad. And then George Sr.'s reaction, really? But can we talk about Jeffrey Tambor as a comedic genius?
Because, oh my God.
That is the scene where he does so many amazing small things that are
yes.
So, I mean, everything that you just described, from the leaning in to the, because this is what he does. He winks and then he takes a drink and looks, I believe to the right as if I am so amazing.
He gets
and
real shifty eyes. Like,
I know, it's just such an amazing bit of acting.
Oh God, it's so perfect.
And then when Michael says, yeah, I don't think that's true, Dad, what his face does when he says, really, everything just drops, really. And because I think you're right. I get the impression that George Sr. tries really, really hard.
He does.
He's just flanked on all sides by idiots. And,
yes.
And because this is one of those callbacks, I have the worst fucking attorneys.
Yeah, yeah.
That's something that he says repeatedly in the show, because he does have the worst attorneys.
Oh, Barry Zuckerkorn. I can't wait to get to Barry.
I can't wait to talk about Barry. I can't wait to talk
so
about
let's
Barry
talk
either.
So we've gone Lucille, Job, Tobias, George Sr. So now let's talk about the lovely Buster.
Okay. You like Buster a lot.
I love Buster. Tony Hale is one of the funniest people alive in this show, and he's just perfect. He's like the best embodiment of a man child that you could ever, like, write on paper is what Buster turns out to be. And he's just so so fucking funny.
He is. Sometimes he's a little too big for my taste.
You think so? Really?
I think so. Let's be clear. It works because he's consistent. So there's never a moment where Tony Hale's performance is inconsistent. He's always consistently big. So I think ultimately it works, but it's a show with just so many big performances.
Yeah, everybody almost feels like they're fighting for the
right, the
audience's
attention. Yeah. Exactly. And I think it works across a season, but just in a pilot episode, it feels like, okay, so that's another big character who's doing a really big thing.
I don't think I see.
Really, you disagree?
Well, maybe because I've seen the show so much.
Right.
If I looked at it with fresh eyes, maybe, but I think that Job being a mama's boy is just so funny. I mean, not Job, Buster. Being a mama's boy is a really funny, one of his character attributes. It's just great. But also, I think that he is weirdly like the comedy relief. That sounds so weird to say in a sitcom, but he always will just pop in from the massaging joke or just falling out of the chair when people are too smart talking. I think it's it just adds another layer of maybe like a physical comedy that is not in the show.
I think you're right. Because one of the things returning to it, it's been easily 5 or 6 years, maybe longer since I've watched season 1.
Yeah.
I've been thinking about this idea, and this is a bit half-baked, but in most TV shows, whether it's Friends or Frasier or even shows today like Parks and Rec, everyone to some degree feels like they're in the same show, mm-hmm. right? So there might be variations. The only time I can think that's not true is a show like Seinfeld, where it's abundantly clear Kramer's in a completely different type of show.
Absolutely, yeah.
This is a show that is so remarkably experimental because Job, Buster, Lindsay, George Sr., they are not in the same show. They are all in fundamentally different shows, but they're all together in the same space.
Yeah,
and I think Michael's
okay.
The same way. Michael is not in the same show that Buster's in. Michael's in a totally different show.
Right.
But watching them interact with one another, I think you're right. That's the thing that works so well because Buster's brand of humor, it feels like old humor.
It's like a Buster. It's almost Buster Keaton.
I was about to say, Buster feels like he's in a silent movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he doesn't need to talk to be funny. My favorite Buster moment, it's after he's collapsed when he's come to the realization that his academic pursuits have not prepared him.
Yeah.
And I believe Job is in the background, and it's a really tight shot, and Buster's on a gurney, and he's brought up to the camera.
Yes.
I just love that.
They're talking about they need Michael, and out of nowhere, Buster comes in the scene. He goes, Michael, we need Michael.
That's so, and I realized that Tony Hale really isn't doing a lot of work there, but just the way, and you talked about the Russos before and how they frame scenes.
Yes, yeah.
And the work they do with cameras. That's so funny. That's so to bring him into the scene like that, because I can imagine doing that scene differently because I am not as clever as they are and the joke not working. But the thing that makes the joke work is pushing Buster up into the frame. And that's so clever.
As a viewer, and the Russos, I guess, know this, is like as a viewer, we see what is confined on screen. And so they use that to make some of the best gags, like in this. I didn't really think about that until I watched it again today. Like, they are using the camera as its own kind of like comedian as well. The camera is saying, here, I'm gonna get you with a zinger. And they do. It's just fantastic.
Well, that's something I wanted to talk about because this is a show that uses the Christopher Guest mockumentary style unapologetically, but I also want to believe it's making a statement about this family through small things like editing and the way they choose to edit things in to what we, the audience, ultimately see that clearly the characters in the scene don't see. So, for example, when Job first mentions the Magician's Alliance, he doesn't see a cut to that picture with that sound. He doesn't see that, but whomever is editing and putting this together and creating and producing this for an audience, is making those kinds of choices for a deliberate reason. And it's to make a kind of statement, because I think this is a show that is certainly trying to be funny, but it seems to want to make statements about this family as well.
Okay.
through very subtle editing choices.
Yeah, you feel like the narrator, or not the narrator, even the narrator, but like,
but the narrator is part of this mechanism.
You feel like he's like this omniscient storyteller.
Well,
that's all around.
I also think they're not objective. They're remarkably subjective.
Yeah.
And there's something about how the author function is used in this show to show us who the heroes are and who the villains are. And then that gets complicated much, much later, because in season 2 and 3, especially, Michael becomes
a villain.
To some degree, a villain.
Sure, sure, yeah.
To some degree, a villain. And Job even becomes remarkably sympathetic in season 3.
Does
when
he?
I think so. I think we get a little bit of it in, it's either episode 5 or 6, when he self-incarcerates to prove a point.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And there's a bit of time spent exploring his relationship with George Sr. and also his role as the oldest son, mm-hmm. and how he was never really treated with the kind of respect that he thought he deserves. And I, at least in those moments, I get the impression that the show is trying to tell me that Job is a far more sympathetic character. He's still an idiot.
Yeah. Oh no.
But yeah. He's a far more sympathetic character than this pilot episode leads us to think, because you're right. The pilot leads us to think that he's just a solipsistic asshole. Mm-hmm. But as the show progresses, we start to see a fuller picture of him as something fundamentally different.
Yeah, yeah. What are your thoughts about Lindsay?
The show doesn't know how to handle Lindsay.
I agree with you completely. Completely. I think she's my least favorite character. I could say that. There are moments where I think she's very funny, but I think that in reality she's very mean, which she gets from her mother. And her and her mom's relationship is probably my favorite kind of her gags. But overall, I'm glad she's in the show. But if I didn't have to see a lot of her, I would probably be okay with that.
Well, I think the show, because the show, at least in the pilot, positions Michael as this heroic, altruistic figure. Mm-hmm. Because we see Lindsay in many ways through his perspective, she is this reformation project, right? She's the one who, if Lucille, Buster, Job, and George are on one side of this binary, they cannot be saved, they cannot be salvaged. Lindsay seems to fit somewhere in the middle, where, because she disappoints Michael, right? Michael says,
sure,
it's at the prison. I have it written down somewhere, but he says something to the effect of, I expect this from them because they're oblivious.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah.
But you should know better, which implies that Lindsay could be like Michael, or Michael thinks she should be like him, that she should be better than she is. And I don't know how long the show keeps to that particular story, because there's a moment of deviation, and I don't necessarily know if I can mark it at this moment, but from the pilot, it seems to imply that Lindsay is this character who will have an arc and she'll grow into a character like Michael. She'll
right.
become more aware, but I think you're right. I think maybe the writers realize just how tedious of a story arc that
might be. I think so.
It's left or abandoned quite early.
Most of her story is just complete vanity, and her relationship with Tobias, which is, it's funny. I mean, it's got a lot of humor to it.
Right.
But I think that the times when her and Michael are alone, and they are like, and you could infer that growing up, they had this kind of like great relationship, you think?
Right.
Because he makes a point to say, why didn't you tell me you were in town, and they're alone, and she's the reason that Michael stays in town, is they're talking and he goes, I want my son to be around his family, you know, because he sees George Michael hug Lindsay. And there's later times, you know, farther down when Michael's in love with Job's girlfriend, and like he has to talk with Lindsay about it. I mean, that's a funny episode, but that's just this sweet moment they have together. And there's those little things kind of peppered throughout. But for the most part, she's just kind of like a raging asshole.
She is. And when her relationship with maybe is given a little more space to grow and develop, it's abundantly clear that she's also a horrible parent.
A horrible mother, yeah.
And she there's an episode later in the season when she's asked by Michael to punish, maybe. And the language she uses and the way she stumbles through that interaction, it's abundantly clear that she's never even thought to punish her child right. for doing something wrong. So she's such a neglectful parent. But I think you're right. She has these moments with Michael, which lead me to believe, at least the show wants us to think, there's something to Lindsay
yeah.
that clearly doesn't exist in all of these other characters. That she, again, could somehow be saved, or that she could be reformed. And that's a really frustrating
yeah.
thing for a show with so many male characters to then have the one female character as the character who needs to be saved.
Yeah, I think it's the one of these. I think we know that Lindsay can make has the ability to make better choices, whereas like Job and Buster have no fucking idea what they're doing.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I see what you're saying. I completely agree.
You could
with
even
that.
Say George Sr. George Sr. has these odd moments where he sounds like the voice of the creator when he says things like family first, or I was doing all of this to protect you. Yeah. It's that moment in the prison when Michael offers his resignation. And we just talked about it a few minutes ago, but his cockamamie logic about you can't prosecute a husband and wife for the same crime. But his motivations were really interesting because he says, and I believe him, I was doing this to protect you and the family.
I believe that, too.
Yeah. So that leads me to think that there are moments in this family's history where maybe not Job, maybe not Buster, but definitely Lindsay and definitely George Sr., these moments where they acted like genuine human beings.
Yes.
And Michael seems to think they can be saved and salvaged. Yeah. And that's worth the undertaking.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that because the show doesn't ever go into like sappy territory, that it works better. It's like with Seinfeld. Seinfeld is a really amazing show, but it never ever gets serious. It never goes into a territory where you have to worry and be concerned. And neither does this. I don't think Arrested Development ever has one point where I actually am worried what's going to happen. I want to see what's going to happen, but I'm not worried about it at all.
Right. I think you're right, because Seinfeld is not a didactic show. It's not trying to teach you anything. I would only disagree with you slightly, because I think if Arrested Development is didactic, it's didactic repeatedly because it overemphasizes this single refrain, which is, family is first.
Okay, sure.
Family is
sure.
first.
Yeah.
But it seems to complicate that didacticism by showing us a family that probably shouldn't be saved. And I wonder if that's maybe part of what the show's trying to suggest, is that people can talk about how much their family means to them, but that doesn't really address if family is always a good thing. The show seems to assume that family is always a good thing, while simultaneously showing us a family that isn't good toward one another.
Yeah.
And creates far more harm, chaos, and trauma than it repairs.
I think, yeah, you're absolutely correct. And it's weird to me, and I mentioned this to you before we started recording, how Michael is just completely... Colin, come on, dude.
I'm sorry.
Colin just poured tea all over himself, listeners. Are you okay?
Oh, I'm fine. Okay. It wasn't really that hot. I'm clearly the Buster of this podcast.
Anyway,
I'm just spilling tea all over myself.
It's bizarre to me how beholden is Michael to like his family. Like he has to, even how shitty they are to him, nonstop, repeatedly just shitty to him. He still is like, I have to be there and take care of them. And I almost feel like he's like, because if I'm not going to be there, these people are going to die. Like they're going to just go into like this caveman sensibility and just die because they don't know what the hell they're doing.
Well, even Lucille, when Michael, so first they call it an intervention, but it's actually an imposition. So because if an intervention needs to be had, we need to have an intervention with his family, yes, right? Michael is not the one who needs intervention. But when that whole conversation ends and Lucille says, I would rather be dead in California than alive in Arizona. And then everyone laughs. I think you're right. That beautifully encapsulates just how just how lost this family would be if Michael wasn't there. I mean, my God, they don't even seem to recognize the gravity of this situation. Dad's in jail. They've put a hold on the company's expense accounts.
Right.
And then everyone gasps.
That's the best joke.
I know. Yeah. I would have thought it would be because Dad's in prison anyway. But I think you're right. And something I want us to talk about as we continue doing this, in this pilot episode, do you like Michael for that very strong position he adopts? I must save my family. Do you like him for that? Or do you think he's because I think the show complicates that position much, much later, that it's less about his family and more about him. But do you like Michael? Do you think the pilot wants us to like Michael for that?
Yeah, I think we have to, because if not, you're just watching a show about terrible people in general. I mean, besides Buster. Buster's not terrible, but everybody else is just.
And I don't think Tobias is terrible either.
Tobias isn't terrible. He just gets into terrible situations. He's just too innocent of a person. Yes. I think you're right. I think we have to connect with someone. And Michael's the only person that regular people can connect to. And he's so snarky. And he's got like this very asshole, smart ass attitude. But it works so well. And I think if I were him, I would be saying the same things. I would also say, like, a lot of the humor that I have comes from that show. Like, and I think you're the same way. Whenever we, like, make remarks on something, we are in that same tone. We use that same kind of style.
I feel like a camera is on me.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm the only person who realizes just how outrageous one situation is to the next. And I'm constantly making these camera turns.
And I do that, too, all the time. Yeah,
yeah, it's – I mean, I just spilled tea on myself, and I don't know if you noticed, but I did this. I turned to my right as if I was addressing a camera.
Do your fake camera.
I know. It's like, guys, can you believe I just did that? What am I doing? I don't know. But I think you're right. In addition to influencing the comic sensibilities of people who produce entertainment, it's at least influenced our comedic sensibilities.
Yeah, yeah.
It's part of my comedic and tonal DNA. I don't necessarily know if I go as far as Michael as to assume that I understand what people around me do not, but if an outrageous situation happens, my instinct isn't to double down and build on that situation. My instinct is to turn right.
Yeah.
As if I'm addressing a camera. Can you believe this has just happened in real life? This is not the kind of thing that happens in real life.
I'm trying to hit all the family really quickly. Are there things you want to talk about?
We didn't talk about the kids because
we could talk about George Michael. Maybe his character's kind of, she says like five things.
Maybe has my favorite, when this is my favorite cut of the pilot. This is it. When they're in the police station and Tobias is explaining what's happened to him. And he's talking about the universe has given him a sign. There is a cut to maybe, and she is doing this thing with her mouth and face where her mouth is agape a little bit, and you can see her tongue moving around inside her mouth. Dead eyes, dead eyebrows, nothing else is happening. It just implies, oh, here he goes again. That is such an amazing cut. There are so many amazing beats in that police station where people are doing things either in the background or the middle ground, and it's clearly not meant to be seen. You were talking about the camera before as deliberately showing us certain things, but that's one of the moments where what the camera tries to show is exactly what we need to see at that moment, because our reaction should be her reaction, like, oh my God, what the fuck is he talking about? Yeah, you're right. Maybe he doesn't say that much, but a lot of her facial gestures and a lot of her mannerisms, they're just so wonderful.
Do you think maybe is in love with George Michael the second that she pretends to want to make out with him? Because I never thought about that till today.
Really?
Like, that could be a very strong possibility.
Because thematically, incest, as bizarre as that sounds, is a frequent preoccupation of the show, right? Incest is used for humor, but it's used in other ways as well, which I'm sure we'll talk about when we get to later episodes. I don't think so. I will say I don't think so, because her motivation seems to be, I want to fuck with my mother.
Right. Okay.
And her whole attitude, this was in my banana. It looks like a foot. It tasted like a foot. And I remember asking for no nuts. That's such, that whole exchange, that's so strange.
So fucking weird.
I know. Yeah. I know. That's so strange. And I'm led to believe that we're just not meant to take maybe seriously. If you could imagine what it would be like to live with Lindsay and Tobias for 13 or 14 years.
Yeah, God bless her. Really.
I'm not entirely sure if I were, if I were maybe, I would be able to take anything seriously based on what my parents have shown me
about, yeah, of course,
how to interact in the world. Because if so much of how we see and understand the world around us, especially when we're in our early to mid-teens, is a product of our environment, what must maybe think about the world? What must I can't even, what is the world to maybe, considering Lindsay and Tobias?
Yeah, I've never thought that deep about your, but she's probably really fucked up.
I know. Yeah. I know. So I don't know. I don't even know if this question of being in love with someone is something maybe's even capable of. I have very strong feelings about maybe, because
you obviously do, yes.
I want to say this is in season two. Season two, she has a story arc where she becomes, I want to say, it's not a CEO, but she becomes a producer, right?
Yeah. Marry me. It's the best joke. I
know. It's one of the She becomes a producer at a major film studio, and she's just so good at lying. And
incredibly good, which I feel like she got from her mom.
I do too, but Lindsay is not good at lying, though. But this is what I mean, right? So Lindsay is really terrible at lying. Every Bluth is horrible at lying. Maybe is very good at lying.
Yes, she is.
And I wonder if maybe regrettably is just a sociopath, a legitimate sociopath who doesn't understand human feelings and emotions.
I don't know.
And
I could totally see that. But there is the moment at the end of, I guess, this season when the house falls and her and George Michael actually kiss and have that moment.
Sure.
Where she's definitely real at that moment.
Okay.
But it's still very, and that leads to so many more questions.
Right. And I'm sure we'll get there, but I wonder if that's behavior she's learned from, yeah, George Michael, or something that has always been inherently part of who she is, because I would argue that it's learned behavior.
So do you think in that regard that George Michael's just really creepy because he wants to make out with his cousin?
I think
I never thought about that, because I think he's like this, I think he's this sweetheart kid, you know, yeah, like Charlie Brown, perfect, obviously.
Sure.
But now that I'm thinking about it, that's really fucked that he wants to make out with his cousin.
It is. It is. And then all the research he does about different countries that allow.
Is it illegal? And like that's a great joke. That's a great gag. Yeah.
Yeah. It's and his fascination with French New Wave cinema because of how it blurs and disrupts normative behavior in relation to, yeah, cousins, yeah, and their presumed sexual attraction to one another. I don't know, because he is so incredibly innocent. So it begs the question, what does he want from maybe? Does he actually want to have sex with her, or does he just like her and love her, but the sexual attraction is something he can't ignore because he's a teenage boy? I'm curious about his motivations.
I wonder if he at that moment just like never been kissed either.
Right.
And because who knows? Because when he is finally kissed by maybe, he just wants it and craves it and needs it.
Yeah.
Over and over and over. So who knows? I mean, but I love George Michael as a character. I think he's a great sweetheart and he has great gags.
I do too.
But overall, he's a little creepy now. I think if they were to film him differently, like with a different, like a Dutch angle with some weird lighting, he would be terrifying.
He would be. But I think that's one of the strengths of the show, is that it doesn't do that. It's that scene when Lindsay, we're told she's assessing the family assets, which means she's stealing things from the model house,
yeah,
which is another funny moment where the narrator is clearly telling us something that isn't actually happening. And that's one of the moments where I think, well, assessing the family assets, is that who wrote that line? Because if it's the narrator and then they show us Lindsay stealing things from the model home, I don't know what that's trying to do as far as the narrator's relationship with what's actually happening in the show. But there's a moment when George Michael, he's speaking to Lindsay, and the conversation begins before Michael enters. And he does this really subtle look to the left where he's looking at his father as if to say, what I'm about to say, we can't leave now because I'm about to say this thing. And I know how you feel about me. And if I perform sympathy in a convincing way, you'll let us stay.
Oh, I don't know.
And it's only after that that he hugs Lindsay. Because the conversation begins with, hey, I wish you guys wouldn't go. I'll really miss you. And then Michael arrives and he says, it's been really hard since mom died. And he does a look to the left.
Oh,
and he's looking
I don't
right
think
at Michael.
So,
I go back and check and see.
No,
I
no,
he does
no.
a he does a look. And but I don't think, but I think this is ultimately my point. George Michael's what, 14? 15?
Probably, yeah.
He's innocent. He's an innocent person who doesn't want to be alone.
Yeah, but I don't think he's conniving. I think if anybody in that episode's not conniving, it's George Michael.
I would challenge you to go back and
well,
watch
we
this
will definitely
again.
Get
I,
into an argument
I,
about
I,
this.
I think we will, because the way that scene is edited, I think it wants us to believe. Because here's my point. He can be genuine and conniving. Those are not mutually exclusive positions. I think he's doing both of those things. I think he's being incredibly genuine. I think George Michael wants family and community, and he's tired of just being alone all the time. But I think he can also use situations to their advantage to get what he wants.
Oh, I don't know that. I feel like we don't have the time for me to discuss.
Well, why
you.
Does that bother you so much, though? To imagine that George Michael's
just this beautiful guy who wants nothing more than to have a good family, and I don't think that. I think if anybody is left that has any semblance of innocence in him, it's George Michael. I don't think that he wants to fuck maybe. I think that he's just this shy teenage boy that's never been kissed. I think that he totally is in love with his family and wants his family, even as crazy as they are. And he is like almost his dad's innocence. He doesn't have any. Maybe he's like his mom. Who knows? We don't know what his mom's like.
Yeah.
And maybe he's just this. I don't know. I just don't want to see him being someone that would use his dad's heartstrings to get what he wants.
Well, I completely understand why you don't want to see him that way. But
that's
what I
so cold blooded, dude. That was
no,
really
what
super
I,
villainy.
What I but this is ultimately what I like about the show. For lack of a better phrase, it doesn't pull punches. It doesn't give you an innocent
oh,
character.
Man.
There are no.
I'm questioning everything
is,
in my
it
life.
Is, I you see, because what I would ask is this: is it possible to be an innocent Bluth? I think the show is really asking this
we
question.
Just went
about,
real deep. With
I know.
This, guys.
I know. I but I like the idea that there is one character who retains his innocence and retains what is special and what is such a rare commodity on this earth, but he will eventually grow out of that, as everyone will. It's only a matter of time.
Oh, man. I don't.
Right?
Okay. Anyway, we are coming close. Let's talk about there's some things you want to do, segments, things we
want
to get.
I want to. Okay. A couple of segments because I love creating segment names. This is really just
this is Colin wanting to toot his own horn.
I know it's there. There's no torn hootery here. I really like segment names. This segment we will call. The banana stand, where we talk about who we think is the craziest and most entertaining Bluth from one episode to the next.
Sure.
So, John, who is the craziest, most entertaining Bluth in the pilot?
In the pilot,
yes.
I say Buster, because
you were doing Buster hands. By
I
the
was
way.
Doing Buster I, hands. Really limp wristed Buster hands. Well, I don't know. I think Buster's the fun. Let me rephrase this. Craziest Bluth is probably Job. Job is like a mad, weird scientist in this episode. He's just constantly yelling and screaming and looking for ways out of things in the worst ways possible. Yeah, he's insane. He is almost pure insanity in this episode. So I'll give the banana stand award this week to Job.
But you wanted to say something about Buster.
Buster is hilarious. And he's, I think, the funniest character in this episode. He also, the massages are awesome. The constant falling out of chairs is awesome. That's just really funny. The fact that he, when the boats are coming and they're trying to get out of there and they're like, Buster, we need you to pilot the boat. And Buster says this line. He says, I don't have any of my map equipment with me. It just made me lose my shit so hard.
I want to see what this mapping equipment looks like.
I do too. Yeah. I wonder if it's just like a pen or like a protractor. That's all he has. And Buster is just, Buster's amazing. I don't think he's the craziest. I think he's the funniest, though.
Okay. My banana stand award goes to Job. It's Job. Job is insane. Job is, and I think Job is consistently insane throughout this show. We will talk about the crazy shit Job does. There's a scene, I'll probably talk about this later, when he, this is, I don't know, episode 4, 5, 6, when he's trying to throw an envelope into the ocean.
Oh, it's so classic.
Because I desperately want to understand. I want Job to do a vagina monologues style one-man show he just explains his interiority, because I don't understand what Job, because you've talked about how Tobias isn't innocent. Buster isn't innocent. So I imagine they see the world and everyone's just a Muppet, basically.
I can agree with that. It's absolutely. Just,
it's that innocent.
Yeah.
I want to know what Job sees, because I think what Job sees, everyone trying to attack him all the time. Because I wonder. He's so defensive about, and all of this posturing seems to be a way of defending himself. But you're right. You said this earlier today. He isn't nearly as successful as he thinks he is.
Right. In every regard of life.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. He's horrible at everything.
Yeah.
He's so, this is much, much later in the season when Michael says Job isn't really good at anything, but Job always talks about how he's good at things.
I think he has to do that as a defense mechanism. He is defensive because I feel like growing up, he was never good enough. And there's a great line in the show where Lucille says, I love all my children equally. And then it immediately cuts to her at breakfast with Buster. And she's
drinking a martini.
She's drinking a martini and she goes, I don't care for Joe.
I want us to go back and look at that scene because I think Buster's eating soup, which... We'll talk about this later.
And Buster gets wide-eyed and he's like, well, really?
Buster has such an odd relationship with soup, though. I think he's eating soup. But yeah, I want to understand how Job was treated as a child, because as the oldest, I get the impression that he had all of these expectations placed on him. And he's a bit of a mouth breather. He's not really good at things. But also the show spends a lot of time talking about how attractive Job is. And Job is an attractive guy. Sure. And also how physical he is. So I get the sense that Job was just always really athletic, but never athletic enough to be really good.
Right.
So I think maybe some of those expectations might have been placed on him. But again, he can never quite, for lack of a better phrase, rise to those challenges.
Poor Job.
He's just, yeah, Job is so insane. He wears that jumpsuit with a polo shirt underneath.
I wonder if he will win every award of every banana stand award. He's pretty fucking crazy.
He is pretty crazy. Well, there's some weird Tobias stuff that happens.
Oh yeah, though there is. I forgot about old Tobias.
I mean, Tobias could have easily won this week. The man dressed like a pirate.
All inadvertently. I didn't mean to do any of this. This is happening now. I'm on a barge full of homosexuals that want to get married at sea. Like, that's what they're complaining about.
They are. You were talking about before we started recording David Cross and how amazing he is. David Cross alone, just ad-libbing or mad-libbing,
oh my God,
is hilarious. He he does this thing where he tweaks his nipple and he says something like, "Hello, sir, you don't look like a pirate." He's so odd.
When Tobias' intro is one of my favorite scenes. He comes out and he's like in this great like hippie crunchy cardigan. It's this huge sweater vest. And he's like, "Michael, how are you?" And like shakes his hand. It's just perfect. I love Tobias.
And then he spends the rest of the scene trying to fix his glasses. So I don't know what. But that's another one of those moments where David Cross clearly made a choice. Tobias will be trying to repair his glasses in this scene. So everything Michael says about the family not receiving the kinds of privileges they have in the past, about how the family needs to find work and find better ways to support themselves, completely missed on Tobias. Not because he can't listen, but because all he really cares about fixing those glasses. He has a problem with his glasses and he needs to fix them. And that's all he's doing in the whole scene. It's amazing.
I love that the only time he gets defensive or gets like has an attitude is after he's been accused of being gay. And then Buster tries to give him a massage and he's like, "Buster," and he gets really in his face.
Well, that happens a couple of times when he's building to this declaration that he wants to be an actor. And Lindsay at one point interrupts and says, "You're gay." And he says, "No, Lindsay, we have talked about this." It's so strange. He's so weird. I may change it to Tobias. No, it's Joby. It's Joby. But Tobias is pretty crazy. I don't know if there's anything else I wanted to say.
Before we go, let's talk about the best jokes in it and like the beginning of some running gags.
Okay, that sounds great. What are some of your favorite, what we'll call callbacks? Because one of the reasons why this show is so hard for some people is because it's a show that builds on its own mythology and it
rewards audiences.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So what are some of your favorite callbacks?
My favorite in the whole thing is, well, the Aztec tomb, because it does play a part later. But definitely the wink face. The wink face is just a classic, amazing Lucille joke. And I want it to happen in every episode. I love it so much. She makes this ridiculously gaudy, terrible skeleton-esque face where she winks at Michael. After she says, "Your dad's going to make a big announcement tonight," she winks at him and leaves one eye like dead eye open. And Michael goes, I wonder how I can get you to never make that face again. And then throughout the whole show, she just does the
wink. Jessica Walters builds on it as well.
And I know that I think
one of her eyes starts twitching at one point.
I want to say George Sr. does the wink. And I think Lindsay also does the wink at some point.
I think it's like the chicken dance. I think everyone gets a wink.
Oh, the chicken. I can't wait till we get to that. But yeah.
I'm so excited. So excited about
those are my favorites.
Okay. Mine, Job as Gob. Every time calls him Gob, I chuckle hysterically. I love that so much. I don't know why. I think it's because it sounds so silly. A magician. And he's usually introduced as a magician called Gob. That's one. We meet T-Bone in this episode.
We do meet T-Bone, yeah.
But he's different in subsequent episodes. We meet housing, and we also see the Bluth banana photo. So there's this bizarre thing where... George Sr., it's what appears to be his official company photo. He's in a suit, but he's holding a Bluth banana.
Yeah.
And I don't know if everyone gets a Bluth banana photo, but it's just such an odd, it's so strange that he's holding. So we get the Bluth banana photo. The police station as a set. They use the police station as a set quite frequently. Mm-hmm. They're always at the police station. Buster's massages.
Buster's wonderful massages.
Good grief as a good. Lucille says good grief 3 times in this episode.
I didn't realize that at all.
3 times.
Yeah.
And I don't know if she's the only one who says it. I think it's in season 2. There's actually an episode called.
Yeah, there grief. Is. It's like the Charlie Brown throwback episode. Yeah.
And also Kitty. We get a reference.
So many Kitty references. I also forgot the one of my favorite jokes is the Buster banging on the drum. It's like a background noise. You don't see him, of course, because the camera shows you what you need to see. Michael's giving this like really angry speech at his family about how he does everything for them. And you hear like the slow, like in the background, you hear this drum beat, and it gets more and more intense, and he goes, "And Buster," and the camera zooms out. You can't do that on the balcony, buddy.
Well, you think at first it's non-diegetic sound,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's just a soundtrack. It's awesome.
And then you realize that, in fact, it is diegetic sound, so that's pretty amazing.
I forgot that joke was in this episode. It's that's a joke people love.
It's so great.
And it's called back later. He does the microwave joke, which is great. Yeah.
Okay. Favorite lines?
I don't know. Go ahead.
Okay. I have four favorite lines. Sounds like you saved enough skin to make 10 new boys.
Right.
That's such a bizarre, disgusting line. But so I know it is. But we're cousins. That's what makes it funny. So Meaty says it first, and then when they're playing, I don't know what card game they're playing. It could be Uno or Go Fish, or George Michael just starts naming card games.
Oh, yeah. Funny, dude. Perfect.
He says, but we're cousins. That's what makes it funny, right? I'm laughing. Uno, Go Fish.
That's so great.
And my favorite, I think I told you this before we started recording, my favorite Arrested Development line, and it's almost impossible to hear, but when Job puts George Sr. in the Aztec tomb because of the police, you can hear, it's so faint, you can hear him say, "Why are you so angry?" He's practically shouting it because he calls it a magic trick, and then Job corrects him and says, "My illusions, you don't have time for my illusions." And you can just hear him, it's ever so faint, "Why are you so angry?"
I think one of my favorite lines comes after that when Job says, "I'm going to make you disappear, Dad." That line and the "What do we always say is most important?" and George Michael says breakfast. That line is just so classic. I think that's about it. Any time that Buster talks is always funny because he like has mumbly talk. It's just perfect.
Well, one quick thing I'll say. Michael asking a specific question and wanting a specific answer, and then George Michael giving him the wrong answer, and then Michael quickly correcting him. That is also a callback because that happens. That happens with manager. It's like, "You are now Mr. Manager." "I'm Mr. Manager." Let's just call it manager.
We used to say manager.
He's always the way he's always correcting George Michael. It's so funny. Oh my God. I have all right, so much.
So I think that's, that was so fun.
How long have we been recording?
Over an hour.
Over an hour. Okay. Yeah. I think that's a nice place to stop for now. I think that's a nice place to stop. So I'll probably record some kind of an outro for us because we have a Twitter account.
Yes.
I hope to have a website for us, although you're better at building websites.
Now that's on me. Thanks.
You are the Squarespace of people.
Thanks, guys.
So, but
we will have a website and Twitter and whatever. I don't know, whatever else. Social media.
We'll figure it out. This is episode one, so we're still putting things together. Yeah. But for the Hop Ons podcast, my name is Colin Cox.
I'm John Phelps.
The Hop Ons podcast is a Nice Marmot production with help from the Cluttered Desk podcast and music by Test Dream. All of our contact information is in the show notes. The easiest way to contact us is through Twitter at Hop Ons Podcast and email hoponspod@gmail.com.